You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our magazine writers read out their pieces from the new issue. This week, we're going to be joined by Jeff Finpool, a historian who debunks what he calls the myth of the American stolen land, i.e. how the European colonialists came to have the continent. We're also going to be joined by Christopher Snowden from the Institute for Economic Affairs, who takes a look at the true cost of coronavirus on the economy. And at the very end, a notebook from Jo Deacon, who writes about the situation of coronavirus in her home country of Madagascar. It's not her real name because of the sensitivities of the topic. First, Jeff Finpool.
Last month, in the middle of the COVID panic, a group of first-year university students at the University of Connecticut were welcomed to their campus via a series of online events. At one event, students were directed to download an app for their phones. The app allowed students to input their home address, and it would piously inform them from which group of Native Americans their home had been stolen. We all know the interpretation of history on which this app is based. The United States was founded by a monumental act of genocide, accompanied by larceny on the grandest scale. Animated by racism and a sense of civilizational superiority, Columbus and his ilk sailed to the New World. They exterminated whoever they could, enslaved the rest, and intentionally spread smallpox in hopes of solving the native question. Soon afterwards, they began importing slave labor from Africa. They then built the world's richest country out of a combination of stolen land, wanton environmental destruction, and African slave labor. This stolen country paradigm is now dominant in our culture. The BBC's recent piece on the 400th anniversary of the Plymouth Landing takes obvious delight in portraying the Pilgrim Fathers as native mutilating slave drivers. In the Greater Toronto School District, students are read a statement of apology acknowledging European guilt for the appropriation of First Nations lands before the national anthem is played over the PA system every morning. It is, of course, necessary to challenge smug, feel-good interpretations of our history. Nationalism and civilizational pride carry obvious dangers which were made manifest by the world wars. But it is also true that if the pendulum of interpretation swings too far in any one direction, things can rapidly go from bad to worse. So what can be the harm in acknowledging every morning that Canadians live on stolen First Nations land? The problem is this. If you begin the day by acknowledging that your country, your society, and people of your ancestry are particularly egregious, this is a sure route to societal self-doubt, impotence, and failure. Democracies thrive or fail on the basis of national stories. This is doubly so in republics like the US, where there is no apolitical figurehead to unite people in place of a monarch. As history shows time and again, as soon as a republic does not believe in itself and its ideals, that it's better than the tyrannies and autocracies surrounding it, it succumbs very quickly to autocracy. The recent riots across the U.S. attest to the breakdown of the Western democratic order, which is being spurred by these self-inflicted wounds. We must bring balance back to our interpretations. History was invented by the Greeks as a science. Its noblest purpose is to discredit those who would use myths to justify hatred, ignorance, and oppression. At the present moment, it's the left, with their cancel culture, who are most guilty of these crimes against history. The myth of the stolen country or Native American genocide does not stand up to scrutiny by any honest and clear-sighted historian. First, no matter who discovered the New World, it's inevitable that a large proportion of New World inhabitants would have died within the first few decades after first contact. This is universally acknowledged by specialists in the field. The New World population was smaller and more homogeneous than the Old World population, so its people had less immunity to disease than the people of the Old World, where disease communities from Africa, Asia, and Europe had been intermingling for millennia. Even though some European captains did try to spread smallpox around a few forts and villages from time to time, the effect of their efforts was almost negligible compared with the natural spread of disease. Old world rice and wheat agriculture could support high population densities per hectare, and the huge disparity in population density between the old world and the new therefore made it likely that excess population was going to flow from the old world to the new. Furthermore, as soon as old world colonists began to set up the farming and city-dwelling societies which they imported from home, population growth in the colonies was bound to outstrip that of Native American groups. Low population devastated by disease is therefore the main explanation for why British North America was so thoroughly Europeanized when many other parts of the globe were not. In fact, the Europeans were surprisingly ungenocidal, given their clear technological advantages over the rest of the world for a period of several centuries. The truth is that few other civilizations, given similar power over so much of the world's people, would have behaved in a less reprehensible manner. This is not to give Europeans a pat on the back. Rather, it is to point out that Europeans are regularly painted as the very worst society on earth, when in fact they had the power to do far, far more evil than they actually did. Rather, it is to point out that Europeans are regularly painted as the very worst society on earth, when in fact they had the power to do far more evil than they actually did. Let us also acknowledge that Native American society was just as warlike as any other in human history. The anthropologist's vision of Native Americans as peace pipe smoking environmentalists, which gained purchase in the 1970s, has long since given way to a more Hobbesian portrait of pre-Columbian reality. In North America, most natives, with some exceptions, had no permanent settlements. They farmed in an area for a few decades until the soil got tired, before moving on to greener pastures. This meant that tribes were in constant conflict with other tribes. It also meant that chiefs were continually vying for power, creating confederations under themselves, and that the question of to whom the land belonged was in a more or less constant state of flux. Meanwhile, some groups of natives slaughtered, bullied, or enslaved others. Should we not be grieving for those Native Canadians whose land was stolen by other Native Canadians? Or is that somehow okay? I don't suppose there's an app for that. Should we not be grieving for those Native Canadians whose land was stolen by other Native Canadians? Or is that somehow okay? I don't suppose there's an app for that. Another major issue is this. What precisely would our pious anthropology professors have had the Europeans do with the New World once they found it? This is not a joke. Political reality has a way of crashing in on the pipe dreams of liberal academics. If the English had not colonized, then the French or the Dutch would have. If the Spanish had not colonized, the Portuguese would have. The only reason that the Arabs and Chinese did not colonize the New World after its discovery is because they did not at that moment have quite the shipbuilding or navigational expertise, even though they were fully capable of sailing thousands of miles around the Indian Ocean. Another accusation leveled against Europeans is that they, quote, destroyed native culture. But let's look for a moment at how cultural contact actually works. The simple fact is that when a good idea comes along, which clearly increases living standards, people tend to adopt it. And who is to say that such adaptation is bad? Native Americans were quick to adapt many useful old world ideas which Europeans had brought with them. Most of these had been adopted by Europeans from other old world cultures. Why grind corn laboriously by hand for several hours a day, when you can use millstones instead? Why hunt with a bow and arrow when you can use a rifle? Why not domesticate cattle? Why refuse to adopt the wheel, for goodness sake? By the time Columbus set sail, the old world had dozens of clear technological and institutional advantages, which for the most part, new world populations were eager to adopt. This made it inevitable that New World society would be changed once sustained contact was initiated. There is therefore little real mystery of what happened to the Native Americans as a culture. They were not exterminated at the behest of any concerted ideology of hatred or European superiority. After the initial epidemics, and in spite of a few sensational wars and small-scale massacres, remaining Native Americans adopted so many Old World customs that most were gradually assimilated into a new culture. This culture was mostly European in British North America, but it was much more hybrid in places like Mexico and Peru, where indigenous population density was highest. Many Native Americans converted to Christianity and took up farming. Hundreds of thousands intermarried, further attesting to the ability of average people of both, quote, races to get along despite the prejudices of pre-modern society. Only a small proportion of Native Americans stayed wild enough to be placed on reservations. Even then, many people later left for a better life elsewhere. This was done on an individual basis, for the most part, peacefully and willingly. And yet the one-sided stolen country narrative continues to gather steam, fueled by a tiny minority of activists, bent on bringing maximum embarrassment to capitalism, democracy, Western civilization, and Europeans in general. The only reason for them to be so unreasonably angry about things that happened centuries ago is because they see everything through the lens of perpetual racism and victimization. And crucially, because they do not believe in the power of democracy to correct these wrongs. Marxists and their sympathizers have always believed that creating a good society is best left to a handful of self-appointed intellectuals than to the rough and tumble of parliamentary debate. Has history taught them nothing? The ones who will really lose out if Anglophone democracy is further discredited are surely those people in the world who are most vulnerable. It is high time historians spoke out against the dangerous misuse of history which supports the zealotry and iconoclasm currently emanating from our educational systems. This has become far too culturally dominant, far too damaging to global society, for us to ignore it any further.
That was Jeff Finpool. And now, Christopher Snowden.
When future historians look back on the 21st century mortality statistics, they will struggle to find anything out of the ordinary in Britain in 2020. When they look at the economic data, they could be forgiven for thinking we were hit by an asteroid. The Office for Budget Responsibility predicts a fall in GDP of around 12% in 2020, the equivalent of having the 2008-2009 recession twice in 1 year. The second quarter saw GDP fall by 20.4%, breaking the record set during the Great Frost of 1709. The economy rallied by 6.6% in July, which sounds impressive until you consider that it only took the economy back to where it was in the spring of 2013. The full impact on unemployment won't be known before the furlough scheme ends, but the OBR expects it to treble to over 4 million, the highest number since the 1930s. The furlough scheme costs £35 billion and is one of the many reasons why the public finances are in such a wretched state. In July, total government debt passed the £2 trillion mark for the first time. The national debt has doubled since austerity began in 2010 and now amounts to 104% of GDP, a level not seen since the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. At the start of the year, the OBR expected public sector net borrowing to be £55 billion. It is now forecast to be £322 billion. Public spending is predicted to rise by £182 billion, while tax receipts fall by £130 billion. Nearly every form of tax is bringing in smaller revenues. It is no surprise that fuel, alcohol and air passenger duties have dwindled, but the government is also expected to get £21 billion less in corporation tax than originally forecast, £23 billion less in income tax, £7 billion less in stamp duty and £11 billion less in business rates. These are only forecasts, but it's worth noting that each of the OBR's four predictions since March has been more pessimistic than the last. A second lockdown would be catastrophic beyond words. Take the damage done by the first lockdown and approximately double it. In some ways it could be less severe, it might be shorter. In many respects, however, it would be worse because it will deliver the coup de grace to businesses that are already on the brink. How many shops, pubs, restaurants and gyms will get through the winter without customers? How long can lower league football clubs play games in empty stadiums before they go bust? Whole industries would be hung out to dry. At the start of lockdown, many commentators, myself included, were reasonably sanguine about the spike in government borrowing. The circumstances were exceptional and the borrowing was a one-off. The jobs and businesses being protected were viable in normal times, and it made sense to mothball them rather than allow them to go to the wall. The rise in borrowing was temporary, not structural, and there was reason to think the economy would return to something like normality in 2021. People having money to spend but nowhere to spend it is a better problem to have than people having no money to spend. A recession was inevitable, but there were hopes that it would be V-shaped as businesses reopened and shoppers made up for lost time. That optimism began to wither when a 3-week lockdown to save the NHS became a 6-week lockdown to flatten the curve and then a 12-week lockdown to, what, eliminate the virus? Prevent death at any cost? Flatten the economy? If there has been a strategy since May, it has never been articulated. If I had to guess, I would say that the plan is to ensure that Boris Johnson is never again accused of acting too slowly. Only a sucker would fall for the idea that the next lockdown will be a mere circuit breaker lasting a fortnight. Supporters of lockdown are adept at switching between cases and deaths depending on which is rising. Deaths lag behind cases by 3 weeks, so even if a 2-week circuit breaker reduced transmission, the number of deaths would still be rising by the end of it. With the likes of Piers Morgan howling from the sidelines, and the zero COVID fantasists re-energised, it is hard to imagine the government ending lockdown with the death rate climbing. You can almost hear the slogan now, one last push to save Christmas. And when case numbers rise again in the new year, as they will, who will resist a third lockdown, especially with the promise of mass vaccination just around the corner? All the while, the money printer will be whirring. According to The Economist, the central banks of Britain, the Eurozone, Japan and the USA have created, which is to say printed, $3.7 trillion this year. If this does not lead to inflation, the economics textbooks will need rewriting. Higher inflation means higher interest rates, and suddenly the cheap money being borrowed won't be so cheap. In the long run, Britain can withstand bungling politicians shaking the magic money tree. Historic levels of debt and employment won't finish us, but the overreaction to COVID-19 will leave scars that define the decade. Future generations will be bewildered that a prosperous country threw its economy off a cliff in a failed attempt to suppress a disease that kills less than 1% of those infected, most of them in their 80s and 90s. They will have every reason to wonder, since they will be the ones paying off the debt, or more likely, paying the interest on the debt. The mounting financial cost is easy enough to measure, but the true cost goes much further than that. How strange are people who believe the dubious factoid about 130,000 people dying of austerity see no negative health consequences from this economic self-immolation? The scale of the disaster is so numbing that even the prospect of a no-deal Brexit barely registers as a problem anymore. Unless a government develops a backbone, the 2020s will make the lost decade of the 2010s look like a golden age.
That was Christopher Snowden, and now Joe Deacon, writing under the pseudonym.
Earlier this month, in his weekly address to the nation, our president, the former DJ and coup leader, Andre Rajoelina, announced that Madagascar would shortly produce an injectable treatment for COVID, a medicinal cure not just for Madagascar, but for the world. This was no great surprise to the people of Madagascar. After all, way back in April when COVID had barely hit our beautifully remote island, President Andre launched COVID Organics, a miracle drink that serves both as a prophylactic and a cure to the virus sweeping the world. COVID Organics, also known as CVO, is based on a herbal remedy for malaria, Artemisia annua, along with extracts from other local plants. While Madagascar has a wealth of endemic plant species, many of which have healing properties that remain underexploited, Artemisia was in fact imported from China, and now the drink is being manufactured in factories hastily erected with foreign investment. For many months, President Andre has extolled the benefits of his elixir. As the number of infections rose, the president confidently assured us that this was simply because not enough people were drinking it. After the first deaths, he said the same. Then later, as the death toll mounted, he changed his tune to say that the real problem was that people weren't drinking enough CVO. In July, when deaths reached triple figures, those of us lucky enough to have television sets and electricity watched as the president and his wife glugged down CVO on camera as if it were lemonade, smiling throughout, in spite of its notoriously bitter taste. While the World Health Organization wrings its hands about the lack of clinical trials, Madagascar is bravely forging ahead. To date, 20 African countries have received shipments of CVO in its drinkable liquid form, which has been marketed as an African solution for Africa. Individuals anywhere in the world can buy it direct over the internet. In Madagascar, a bottle of CVO costs 40 pence in the local supermarket. Online, it retails for $100 plus shipping. Perhaps the president thinks of it not as a cure for the virus, but for the economy. Economic stimulation is definitely much needed. For most people, life is hard in Madagascar. Famines occur so regularly that there is even a season for them. And the efforts to constrain the coronavirus have worsened an already difficult situation. Like many other countries, Madagascar has gone into lockdown. People rush to make it home before curfew, their face masks dangling around their chins. Children play together in the dust outside of the locked school gates. The hotels and restaurants are empty, swimming pools drained. Health checkpoints have been set up by the side of the road, and people jostle each other as they wait in line for a temperature to be taken before entering town. In the developing world, a cut in income quickly translates into increased malnutrition, inability to pay for basic medicine, and death from starvation or entirely treatable illness. So far, just over 200 people have died from COVID in Madagascar, a country with a population of 27 million. The lives lost due to the indirect impacts of COVID, from famine, decreased vaccinations and medical care, are likely to be orders of magnitude greater. I was recently telling my youngest son the story of Hansel and Gretel and the wicked stepmother who led them away to die in the forest, as they could not afford to feed them anymore. There's nothing allegorical about this tale to a Madagascan. It is something we see daily. A Malagasy friend developed a fever which refused to go away. Eventually, he stumped up the money for a doctor. "It's all fine," he said happily when we saw him later. "It's not COVID, after all. It's only typhoid fever." Since March, three people we know have died. Two of food poisoning and one of dysentery. Hygiene levels are lethally low here. Diarrhea and dysentery kill, as do infectious diseases like tuberculosis, measles, malaria, hepatitis, and plague, bubonic and pneumonic. Meanwhile, international aid has been diverted from vaccination programmes, food aid, and basic health and sanitation work to fund the fight against COVID. This has been done with no analysis of the relative costs and benefits. It has been blithely assumed that COVID represents a greater risk to this generally youthful population than other fatal communicable diseases. The cycle rickshaw drivers at the bottom of our street, who live a hand-to-mouth existence in any case, are muttering about rioting. With tourists gone, their usual clients, the cleaners and the waitresses, and the food suppliers who serve the tourists no longer have the spare change for a rickshaw ride into town. Their union has declared that there will be a riot if there is further lockdown. The government has threatened to send in troops from the capital to quell any rebellion. "Bring it on," the rickshaw drivers replied. "Better to die fighting in the streets than to starve to death in our homes."
That was Joe Deacon. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week.